Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order and let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:39 PM on Tuesday, April 11th, 2023. And I believe we've got everybody here today, Representative Josephson, Representative Hannon, Representative Galvin, Representative Stapp, Co-Chair Edgman, Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Kronk, Representative Ortiz is online. Representative Ortiz, are you there?
I am, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Right, thank you. And Representative Colomb and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. And this afternoon, we'll hear a presentation from the Department of Natural Resources on House Bill 50. That is the carbon storage bill. And the presentation includes the concept of carbon storage and the walkthrough of the legislation. And just want to reiterate something I mentioned yesterday, which is I think both the bill from yesterday and today, they're very new concepts, and so we'll take our time making sure that folks understand the concepts, and also feel free to ask questions as we go through the presentation. So we're not holding them till the end. We'll go ahead and ask questions throughout, and I think there are a couple natural stopping points here that I'll check to see if folks have questions. So with that, at this time, I'd like to ask Department of Natural Resources Deputy Commissioner John Crother and Commercial Analyst for the Division of Oil and Gas, Ryan Fitzpatrick, to come to the table. And we also have the Commissioner Department's Commissioner Designee, John Boyle. And I believe, is the Commissioner online? Commissioner, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, I'm online.
Okay. And let's see here. With that, I also want to mention that we have a number of people online also available for questions, it looks like. And so we've got a reservoir engineer, petroleum engineer, we've got DNR's Division of Oil and Gas. Let's see here. Department of Laws online, and also a geologist with the Geological and Geophysical Survey. So with that, if you could put yourselves on the record and go ahead and start with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Foster. For the record, this is John Crother. I believe our commissioner, Commissioner Designee Boyle, would like to give some introductory remarks, so we'll let him kick it off.
Okay, Commissioner.
Yeah, good afternoon, Co-Chair Foster, members of the committee. This is John Boyle. I'm the Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, and I apologize for not being in the room with you today, but I'm in beautiful Delta Junction, Alaska, working to market some of our wonderful forests that we have up in this area. But I am thrilled to be here to talk about HB 50. I see HB 50 as one of the more important pieces of legislation that we can enact this session. And the reason that I believe that is that we have an incredible opportunity in the state to work to diversify our economy and to work to raise new revenues through the monetization of what heretofore has been an unmonetized resource. And that is the empty pore space that we have, you know, in our, under the ground. There is a lot of opportunity for the state to position itself strategically to be a locale where carbon is sequestered. We know that the storage potential that we have in the Cook Inlet exceeds 50 gigatons. You know, this is more CO2 than the country of Japan will emit across a 50-year period of time. And that's just an incredible resource, actually, to have it, you know, at the, in a location to where there are opportunities for us to potentially export energy in the form of LNG, potentially hydrogen, potentially ammonia, assuming that we can work to get the pieces together to advance the AKLNG project, and the opportunity to create a value chain to where we're exporting carbon energy to Asia, and then backhauling carbon that's emitted from factories in Japan, South Korea, and the like, and to sequester here in Alaska could just create an inordinate amount of opportunities, you know, as we look, you know, well ahead in the future. But for the more immediate long term, I think there are opportunities here based upon the fact that the federal government in the last Infrastructure Act increased the amount of tax credits available to companies pursuing carbon capture utilization storage opportunities. So the 45Q tax credits, which you'll hear about, really have changed the economics to the point to where a lot of projects that didn't make financial or economic sense, you know, just a few years ago, today make a lot of economic sense. And part of the reason for the impetus or the reason why we, the state, are pushing to have, you know, this legislation enacted soon is that these tax credits that are included for carbon capture utilization and storage projects do have a shelf life. You know, there is a window of time after which they may expire if Congress does not choose to extend these particular credits. And so for us, there are a number of companies that already exist in the state that are interested in pursuing carbon capture utilization and storage projects. And so for the state to have that regulatory framework in place that we can provide those opportunities for emitters of carbon to capture those emissions and then sequester them under the ground here in the state, are enormous. So we really want to, you know, to be prepared for that. And the process of that is, as you'll hear in testimony, will take some time, primarily with AOGCC pursuing primacy for Class 6 injection wells through the EPA. And that's a process that we've seen, at least in other states, take, you know, at least a number of years, although we do have a high level of confidence based upon the fact that EPA has put funding or made funding available for states to utilize as they apply for primacy. They've certainly signaled that they're interested in states taking on this role. And so we would, you know, hope to see, you know, that process move along maybe more timely than in some other instances. But still, you know, it will take the state some time to get this framework in place. But, you know, as you look again for kind of existing opportunities, clearly we have processing and power generating facilities on the North Slope, which emit a significant amount of carbon. We have a number of coal-fired power plants in the interior that also would provide opportunities for carbon sequestration and other facilities around the state where it might make sense. And then again, as we kind of look more longer dated, it's really about looking at the AKLNG project and having that understanding that a major component of that project actually is a gas treatment plant on the North Slope that's taking CO2 out of the natural gas before it's shipped down the gas pipeline to Nikiskie. Having this framework in place that would enable that project to take advantage of 45Q tax credits to give it, you know, another financial incentive or you know, element that would help make the overall project more economic is very important. And lastly, I'll just close by saying that to me, the most exciting element of the carbon capture, utilization, and storage part of the bill is the fact that our Supreme Court has ruled that the empty pore space that we have underground is part of the mineral estate for the state. And that means that a portion, you know, 25% of the revenues that we would generate or fees that we would charge for project developers that want to inject carbon under the ground, you know, that portion of revenue would actually grow to growing our permanent fund, which, again, I think is just an incredible opportunity for the state to monetize a resource that hasn't been monetized before, grow our permanent fund in the process, and also create, you know, other really interesting opportunities for value-added types of manufacturing and other things that actually can derive from stored carbon and opportunities like that. So it, to me, there, you know, I know that it's a lot to wrap our minds around, but there's a lot of incredible opportunities there. We've got a great team of folks that can help, you know, walk you guys through some of the elements of the bill and also walk through, you know, where we see a lot of the opportunity for the state. But we're very excited to present this to you and looking forward to your questions and discussion as we move through the elements of the bill.
Great. Thank you very much, Commissioner Boyle. I don't see any questions. We do have a question, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Mr. Boyle, you said, and I'm going to roughly paraphrase, that there is a window of opportunity for us to take advantage of the 45Q tax credit, and it looks like in the presentation it talks about 2033 having to be the year that you've begun construction. So when you're referencing that window of opportunity, are you seeing it as a 10-year window, or you started with, we need to pass this bill this year, sort of implying that there was a shorter window than that? So could you describe to me what you view as this window of opportunity separate from what that tax code provision says? So is there some other pressing deadline that we got to do this now, or we've missed the opportunity?
Yeah, Representative Hannon, through the chair, it's a great question. I think I was trying to allude to that window of when, you know, projects have to be under development in order to qualify for the 45Q tax credits. And I don't have the figures on the top of my head. I'm going to assume that the year that you threw out is correct. So basically what I was implying is that the sooner the state has this regulatory framework in place, the sooner AOGCC can go out and start applying for primacy, then that gives companies more time and opportunity then to get projects, you know, under development and qualify for this, you know, for those tax credits so that we can start recognizing some of the benefits of that opportunity. And then in addition, you know, for instance, there may be, it may also help AKLNG or AGDC, for instance, if they know that there's this framework in place for carbon sequestration, that could be, you know, a tool that they utilize to, you know, again, kind of engage with the markets and maybe find, you know, different opportunities for financing for the AKLNG project. So there's a lot of benefits that we see that would result from the state being able to pursue this more timely.
One follow-up,
and I, Chair Foster, there is a fiscal note from revenue, but it's zero, and so I'm wondering if the expectation is we wouldn't see any revenue for less than 10 years from now, and so it doesn't show in those fiscal notes, or, of course, it's been described as an economic opportunity to develop revenue, not just have another oil and gas processing going on in Alaska, but to generate revenue for the state. And it's not reflected in the fiscal notes, and I couldn't find them in the previous hearings. So just trying to understand that.
And Commissioner Boyle, it looks like if you could put yourself on the record here.
Yeah, for the record, John Crow, the Deputy Commissioner, Representative Hannon through the chair. I think we'll speak to you on our presentation some hypothetical scenarios about the scope and timing of revenue. The department believes it's possible to see things like initial leasing revenue very soon after passage, but because of the novelty of the concept, the new development, and the need for project developers to engage once the framework's in place, we haven't identified a specific revenue amount in a given year, and so that's my understanding of what's reflected in that Department of Revenue fiscal note. But we believe we could see revenue within that 10-year window.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Anything further? I don't see any. So with that, thank you very much, Commissioner Boyle. And so as we move forward in the slide deck, if maybe you could just reference the number of the slide that you're on just for folks who are on the phone for them to be able to follow along. So with that, if you could both put yourself on the record and go ahead and start with your presentation.
Yeah, Chair Foster, members of the committee, thanks so much for your time. This is, again, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Natural Resources. And my colleague?
Ryan Fitzpatrick, commercial analyst with the Division of Oil and Gas.
And so for the presentation today, we'll go through, if we can go to our first introduction table of contents slide. We'll walk through a variety of topics today. I would note for the committee, the introduction portion is actually going to be quite significant just as we line out some basic concepts and issues associated with this topic, carbon capture, utilization, and storage, CCUS. And then we'll get into the other items listed here, project overviews, some information about funds that could accrue to the state revenue, as well as hopefully we'll get into a detailed sectional analysis of the bill and the authorities that it gives both the Department of Natural Resources, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and the associated state agencies. So I'll move to slide 3 if there's no questions. And just given the amount of material, I'll move quickly through these first introductory slides, but this slide 3 shows our Department of Natural Resources constitutional mandate. Article 8 deals with natural resources, so we focus on it every day in all of our authorities. But it requires us to make our resources available for maximum use. And as the commissioner described, we believe our pore space is an increasingly valuable natural resource. And from the department perspective, we're bringing this bill forward to fulfill and meet that mandate to make it available for use. The Constitution also references the need for reasonable concurrent uses. And that's why, as you'll see in the legislation, we've taken great consideration to make sure this kind of activity can go forward in the context of other surface and subsurface uses, valuable uses of our state resources. So without questions, I'll move to slide 4. So I touched on these topics already, but we believe this bill does meet that constitutional directive. We believe it makes our pore spaces, our subsurface resources available. In addition to the development of minerals, oil and gas, which are longstanding activities in Alaska, this would make that sequestration activity an authorized use and provide a framework for it. It would protect reasonable concurrent uses, so existing oil and gas operations, new oil and gas operations, other surface uses, we believe would all be concurrent with this or consistent with this framework. And as I mentioned before, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission receives a significant amount of authority in this legislation, as does the department, though we view those authorities as very consistent with the current authorities we use to manage our oil and gas resources. And so that we, in a sense, already have these capacities, both at AOGCC, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and at DNR. And we worked as hard as we could to match this CCUS framework to our existing oil and gas framework. And with that, I'll move to slide 5. So this is there's a lot of words on slide 5 here, but this is, a lot of these topics have already been covered, but we're talking about carbon capture, utilization, and storage, CCUS. And so in a single sentence, that's an effort to capture carbon dioxide from a variety of sources, industrial sources, coal, energy generation, even directly from the air, to transport it and potentially to utilize it for other beneficial uses, but also to store it deep underground in geologic formations. And so that activity is driving investment and interest all across the country and all across the world, and that brings us into the why now. As the commissioner described, we're seeing tremendous activity here. We want the state to be participating in it. We want that investment to come to Alaska. We want to utilize our prolific natural resources as we see this activity incented by the federal tax credits. As the commissioner referenced, the timeline for getting projects online is a big driver here, because that 2033 timeline may seem 10 years out, and it is a long way out, but all the steps that need to occur between now and project construction are quite significant, and we want to get into that space as soon as we can, make these frameworks available so, as the commissioner referenced, people making business decisions today can know that this kind of opportunity is developing in Alaska, even if there's still regulatory steps we have to take, even if there's still different authorities we need to gain, they know that statutory framework is in place and that the state's actively working on it. And then I just would stress as well for the committee, we believe we have tremendous potential in Alaska. The same kinds of geology that make us a prolific energy producer, a world-class oil and gas basin, hydrocarbon basin, or host to multiple hydrocarbon basins, are those same kind of geologic resources that are conducive to carbon storage. So obviously our depleted oil and gas fields, one area to potentially store carbon, but also saline aquifers, which are essentially geologic formations underground that, instead of being filled with oil and gas, are filled with highly saline, highly mineralized water. So it's deep, deep underground, not usable for any other beneficial purpose, But today we're now seeing that that's an area that carbon dioxide can go and be sequestered. And similarly, deep, deep coal seams are another target that we have a great deal of in Alaska, have never had a use for until today.
Great. We've got a question from Representative Galvin.
Thank you, co-chair Foster. Through the chair, I just hope that you'll give us a little bit more, and maybe it's in here later, but when you mentioned the expanding market, seems like in Alaska, as it is, we do not have a whole lot of CO2 to put to sequester. So naturally, I'm assuming that you're looking at the Asian market, which I think the commissioner referred to. But I don't know if the market is such that has there already been precedent where we're seeing CO2 go from one country to another. If you could help us understand a little bit more about this, just feels like a big project that's going to require quite a bit of infrastructure, even the right kind of ships to move it. I'm assuming that's what it would be. And so I just hope that we can understand more of the picture of that. And the other thing I wanted to ask you, if I may, through the chair, is through this discussion, if you can help me to know, is this a revenue project? Or is this a project to help us with the changing ways that oil and gas is doing their work, which I know is cleaner as time progresses. We're looking at more and more green development, and this maybe is a match for that. And I'm just trying to figure out the difference between both, knowing that the market really, as far as I can see when I did my own little tiny bit of research, didn't see that the global market is yet developed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Representative Galvin, through the chair, I think we will endeavor to articulate or expand on both those questions throughout our presentation, but I think they're very, very relevant and help kind of set the stage as we go into it. So taking them in reverse order, we at the department view this as kind of a both solution in the sense that this is a resource of the states, the pore space. It can generate revenue. As the commissioner said, that revenue, mineral revenue, partially dedicated to the permanent fund. And so that's an important part of establishing that framework is a new revenue source. But there is the, you know, enabling other beneficial use of our resources that we think is very, very important. Something like a coal resource around the country and around the world, people are limiting their use of coal because of the carbon dioxide emission. If there's a way to eliminate the emission of that carbon dioxide into the air, our coal resource can be beneficially used for Alaskans, generate cheap, reliable power, potentially continue to be exported. And so, you know, I know that that gets into an area of debate about the wisdom of using that kind of resource. But from the perspective of if carbon emissions are the problem, then carbon management is the solution. And we want to be making our resources available for that. So we think it has the associated activities have real benefits for the state and people of Alaska, but the revenue can be there as well. And then as far as the scale of projects, longer term, we do see the potential for shipping import of carbon into Alaska. There are projects being developed, ships being built right now to enable the ocean-going transportation of carbon. There's test cases going on in kind of an inter-country shipping. There's barging of carbon dioxide in some locations. But we see potentially carbon from Southeast Asia coming to Alaska on a large scale as a possibility. But we don't think that's the only reason this framework could be really important and successful to Alaska. You know, the existing activities we have, whether they're power and energy generation or whether they're oil and gas production, do emit carbon dioxide. And being able to manage that, we think, would advantage investment and those activities continuing and expanding, which is very valuable to the state. And so whether we're looking long-term and big picture or short-term today, we think there are people who would make active use of this framework. And that's, we've seen support and engagement from existing operating companies in Alaska, in addition to entities that are looking longer-term at that global market and transportation of carbon dioxide.
Representative Galvin, is that?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Hennen.
Thank you, Chair Foster. I want to just affirm, Mr. Prother, that when saline aquifers
in my mind, those are all still related to oil and gas field development. It's just that down that long tube, it's encountered a saline aquifer. Or are there some other circumstance that I'm not thinking of, that these are separate from oil and gas and deep coal seams? There's some other way that we've got saline aquifers that would be where we were capturing and sequestering?
Yeah, Representative Hannon, through the chair, I will get into that a little bit more, but essentially it's the saline aquifers are often co-located on a kind of basin level with oil and gas fields because the kind of geology that forms them is the same kind of geology that can trap and collect oil and gas if there's a petroleum charge in the system that leads hydrocarbons to migrate into those structures. But if in the areas where there isn't that hydrocarbon migration, my understanding is often that the water and the other saline minerals accumulate there in these same kinds of formations. So they're often co-located, but not inherently absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. And please proceed with the presentation.
Yeah, so slide 6 here is a little bit of a cartoon drawing of some of the things we've already talked about, the CCUS, all the different stages that enable it. On the left, you see the capture. So that's things like working to capture the smokestack emissions of a coal power plant, chemical byproducts of an industrial process, or even people are working on what they call direct air capture, which is filtering carbon dioxide out of the general air. When that carbon is captured, it has to be transported. We were just talking about the potential ocean-going transport, but today that transportation is most commonly very short distances or through pipelines. There's the potential use of carbon dioxide, everything from carbonating beverages, food products. Enhanced oil recovery is a very common utilization of carbon dioxide that's going on today. But it's possible in the future there may be other advanced materials, industrial applications for carbon dioxide, and so people are actively exploring those all around the world. But what the bill really focuses on is that bottom piece, the storage, and that's where carbon dioxide is concentrated, pressurized, and injected underground for permanent sequestration. I'll move on to slide 7. So this is, at a very high level, to frame up for the committee. We've talked about some of these things already, but when we look at this slide, this is from the International Energy Agency, and this is their a graphic from their net zero by 2070 conception. It is a hypothetical framework where in 2070, the world's economic activity is quote-unquote net zero. So all the carbon emissions that occur are managed, sequestered, limited through a variety of means. We're not saying that will happen or is likely to happen, but this is, in this realm of energy transition, a very aggressive, very fast-moving, complete transition. And the thing that I find very interesting from this chart is when you look at 2070, this identifies how many CCUS facilities the IEA believes will be needed to fully manage that net zero transition and provide carbon sequestration on the scale needed. And when you look there, on the right side of the chart, you see biomass, natural gas, and coal still being a huge part of the energy mix, but the carbon dioxide from it is sequestered underground. So that in the hypothetical 2,500 different new facilities that would need to be developed, today we have 35 operating. But for Alaska, we have world-class biomass resources, world-class natural gas resources, world-class coal resources. And so if CCUS enables all of those resources to be as valuable or more valuable 50 years from now, we think that's a tremendous win for the state. And so that's really what this slide is meant to show, is that CCUS enables not just short-term projects in Alaska, but potentially long-term value, consistency, or even growth for our other natural resources. Next slide, slide 8. This is a very wordy slide, but it's an excerpt of all the different companies, oil and gas companies operating in Alaska, and their self-identified, self-described goals for carbon management. Many of these companies have net zero goals where all the emissions associated with their operations are going to be either offset, reduced, or sequestered. And so they essentially are customers for the state as we bring our CCUS pore space resources available forward. And, you know, obviously Santos and Repsol made a recent major sanctioned a major investment in Alaska. And carbon management they view as a key part of that to enable that project to be net zero. ConocoPhillips and Exxon have set goals to benchmark and manage their emissions on a going forward basis. And even Hilcorp, a private company in the upper right there, you see an acknowledgement from their leadership that they need and want to participate in carbon management projects to continue to get investment, to continue to make their products available for customers. And I think with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague Ryan to move through the details of CCUS.
Got a quick question, Representative Johnson, Co-Chair Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to, as I look through here and look at the names on this list, are all these companies that already invest in, and have investments on the, in Alaska?
Representative Johnson, that's correct. They all are currently operating in Alaska.
Okay. And so this is a little bit, just a little curiosity question, but is there technology to allow drilling and removal and injection at the same time?
Yeah. So Co-Chair Johnson, that in short answer, yes. So when people are producing from hydrocarbon reservoirs today, they're having to navigate other, you know, layers, other strata in that subsurface to access the oil and gas targets that they're seeking to develop. Essentially, if there's carbon storage going on in an area, it's another consideration that has to be taken into account in those well designs in the project development. And so an operator would have to understand both existing wells, existing production, and reservoir dynamics, but it's entirely possible that carbon dioxide could be sequestered in the same kind of geologic column that oil and gas production is occurring from if it designed appropriately and regulated carefully by the AOGCC.
Thank you.
Please continue.
All right. And for the record, Ryan Fitzpatrick with the Division of Oil and Gas. Next slide, we're looking at a map of the state of Alaska and looking at potential storage basins. There was a study that was done by the Department of Natural Resources about 10 years ago looking at the potential for carbon storage within the state. They identified different geologic basins in the state where carbon storage might potentially occur. And sort of high-graded some of the better potential reservoirs for carbon storage. So you note, you know, the North Slope and Cook Inlet both show up in blue on this map, indicating that they're high potential for carbon storage. Mainly that's the result of the fact that this study looked at not just the geology of the storage, but also the existing infrastructure, the skilled labor in the area. And so both of those areas had the geology to support storage, but also the infrastructure already available. Some of the numbers that no doubt members have heard, the idea that Cook Inlet may have upwards of 50 gigatons of storage, that figure has been sourced to this particular report. That number, the 50 gigatons, referred to coal seam, deep unmineable coal seam storage. It also indicated there's additional potential in Cook Inlet for saline aquifers, and it didn't look either at oil and gas reservoirs. So the 50 gigatons may be a low side potential for Cook Inlet. I would say, however, as a note of caution, this is a very high-level study, you know, very initial look at the potential geology. And as we've seen with oil and gas developments in the state of Alaska, you can have great rocks, great potential, but it's really, you know, a matter of getting into looking at particular projects, making sure that a particular project is both supported by the local geology and by the economics around that project to really make a project work. And so we do have tremendous potential in these areas, potentially outside of these areas as well. But that is something that would require further study and refinement to get to a really solid number around what that potential storage might be.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, and through the chair to the folks at DNR. So just out of curiosity, if we go forward with this and we sequester a high amount of carbon in the Cook Inlet Basin, geologically that's high prone to earthquakes and things like that. So what is the potential liability in the event that our carbon sequestration coal seam effectively gets ripped open by a big earthquake and all that carbon goes back up? Thanks.
Representative Stopp, through the chair, I think there may be kind of two questions there, and I'd say in the first one, from a liability perspective, if there is a an act of God release of carbon dioxide that's stored, there are limited clawback provisions for those federal tax credits within a 3-year window, and that's when that liability would be with a project operator. The framework in the bill does establish a transfer of liability longer term after a regulatory review and closeout and then a 10-year period. But as we understand it, there wouldn't be liability with the release of that carbon dioxide. And that's because that tax credit clawback period is closed. Carbon dioxide is not a regulated pollutant in the sense there's no fee for emitting it or charge if it's discharged. It's part of the natural atmosphere already. So from a financial liability, we don't view that as something the state would be taking on in a significant manner. I think you were also asking potentially about, induced seismicity of the in the Cook Inlet's obviously a seismically active basin today. That activity goes on as part of the natural processes. And there has been in some parts of the country induced seismicity when there's very high pressure injections in geologic formations. So for carbon sequestration, the intent is to inject it at a pressure that maintains the structure of the reservoir, does not fracture it, does not overpressure it, and so the carbon dioxide successfully migrates through, and that would be required as part of the injection approval by AOGCC, which we believe is very unlikely to induce that seismicity. And I believe Marwan Wartes of our DGGS, Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, is on the line and can speak to that as well. But then, finally, I would just note that Cook Inlet has seen seismic activity just in the kind of human relevance period of major earthquakes. In a geologically relevant time period, we expect there have been many Good Friday earthquakes over the time relevant time period, and we've still seen those oil and gas reservoirs maintain, those accumulations stay in place without evidence of migrating to the surface. So there's a lot of analysis being done on those questions, and we think that they don't raise significant concern.
Just for the record, that was Mr. Crowther.
Yeah,
do you have a follow-up, Representative Stopp?
No, that's good. Thanks.
Okay. Please proceed. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Co-Chair Johnson.
Thank you. So I'm just wondering, as I look at the slide that has the different basins on it that look like they have some potential, a lot of them are inaccessible, but some are there where there's active, oil extraction. But what I guess I'm wondering about, it seems like it would be a little maybe far-fetched, depending on, what really were to happen, that people would be shipping carbon from a long ways away here. But if we're talking about CO2 and we're talking about, say, a natural gas container that shipped out of Alaska, could they backhaul some kind of compressed carbon in the same ship?
Chair Johnson, so this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner. It's our understanding that what people are looking at right now is that LNG tanker requires specific terms or technical requirements for the LNG transport. So it's much more likely that backhauling would be done on something like an ammonia container, potentially a hydrogen ship that's transporting hydrogen. And so we don't think with current technology that LNG tankers can be backfilled. But as that market matures of transporting LNG and other fuel sources like hydrogen or ammonia on a kind of international basis, we think that'll co-evolve with the potential shipping of carbon dioxide. As you said, it's not guaranteed, it's not inevitable, but there's active work to understand it, to advance it, to develop ships to do it in other jurisdictions.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Please continue.
All right. So the next slide is just a representation of sort of the potential targets in the geologic strata for sequestration. We've got a rather precise measure of depth there. You can see several space needles. It's highly technical in terms of depth measurement. As you can see, the idea here is that we're sequestering the carbon very deep underground. The injection targets are going to be well below sort of freshwater, groundwater, drinking water columns. The targets really are, as has been alluded to earlier, depleted oil and gas reservoirs, those saline reservoirs, and potentially unmineable coal seams. We'll get into this in another couple of slides, but there are sort of technical reasons why carbon that's injected underground needs to be at least a certain depth, and that depth is well below groundwater depth. And if there's no questions, I'll move on. So this is just summarizing several points about carbon storage. Obviously, we've got the potential geologic formations for storage. Those formations for storage need to be lower than 2,600 feet. And the reason for that that technical limitation is that in order to optimize storage of carbon underground, the CO2 needs to be kept at what's called a supercritical liquid phase. And that is where the gas is compressed to the point where it exhibits the same physical characteristics of a liquid. It may not actually be a liquid, but exhibits similar physical characteristics. At that point, it becomes very, very compressed, and so it's much easier to store in that very compressed form. In order to keep that pressure underground, however, the injection needs to occur below 2,600 feet. And so that's the reason why this sort of injection takes place very deep underground and well below potential drinking water sources. Obviously, when you're looking at formations for potential geologic storage, you're looking at similar considerations as oil and gas. You're looking at the porosity and the permeability of the storage reservoir that you're injecting into. You're looking for those geologic traps in order to make sure that the reservoirs maintain integrity over a long period of time. And then with CO2 storage, there is sort of that closeout period where CO2 injection, the monitoring of that CO2 once it's being stored underground is important as well. And I'll move on. This slide summarizes some of the federal incentives that have been alluded to earlier. The 45Q tax credit is part of the Internal Revenue Code by the federal government. As alluded to, there's the deadline to start construction by January 1st, 2033. And so as we think about the timeline in order to allow for construction to occur in 2033, there's the period of time that AOGCC will need to go through its Class 6 primacy phase. Right now, AOGCC, I believe, is estimating that that would take about 2 years for them to go through the process of obtaining Class 6 primacy from the federal government. In addition, once that's occurred, any potential project under development would have to go through exploration, would go through licensing, convert into a lease. And so the same sort of dynamics that we would see with oil and gas developments, which cause for potentially extended development time periods, could potentially relate to these sorts of developments as well. So layering on both the classics primacy period in addition to that project development period, 2033 is 10 years out, but that is part of the reason that we're looking at this and saying that there is a potential desire to try and move quickly on taking advantage of these opportunities. The credit itself varies potentially fairly significantly depending on the type of operation. There's a credit for base sequestration, pure sequestration, not sequestration that's associated with enhanced oil recovery. That credit is up to $85 per ton. There's an additional credit. If you're doing enhanced oil recovery, you still get a credit. It's just less. It's up to $50 or $60 a ton. And then for sequestration that's associated with direct air capture, or direct atmospheric capture, and that's capture of CO2 directly from the ambient air. CO2 sequestration associated with that is up to $180 per ton.
And a question, Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, for either gentleman, the second bullet point there, the enhanced oil recovery, since we're doing that now, would our producers be entitled to that tax credit now, or do they have to prove up additionality in some way to get the 45Q tax credit?
Mr. Patrick?
Fitzpatrick. Yes, Ryan Fitzpatrick for the record. It's a very good question. So for enhanced oil recovery, that can occur presently under current oil and gas operations. It's allowed as a substance to be injected in order to maximize the recovery of oil and gas. For that, there are measuring, there's a requirement to measure the amount of CO2 that's injected. And so there has to be some form of measurement that takes place in order to certify the amount of CO2 that's injected into a formation for enhanced oil recovery. My understanding is that there also needs to be some measurement of the potential for any CO2 that might be reproduced along with that operation. And so it's possible that if hypothetically you injected, let's say, 10 tons of CO2 into a formation, but a ton of that were reproduced as part of the oil and gas operation, that I think you only get credit for the 9 tons that remains within the formation, not for the extra ton that was reproduced during operation.
Follow?
And I think that the deputy commissioner referred to this, so I may have my answer, but is it possible for AOGCC or the state to apply for Class 6 primacy without this enabling? Or would the EPA say you must first have the Enabling Act?
Mr. Crowther?
Yeah, Representative Josephson through the chair. This is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner. So it's our understanding, so that Class 6 primacy, AOGCC could pursue it and gain that authority, and that would be beneficial for them to have it. It would primarily be applicable to private lands in Alaska, people who wanted to do projects on those private lands, because we would have limited capacity to clearly and confidently bring our state resources, make them available with clear commercial terms for a party to undertake an investment. And so that's why we believe both pieces of legislation are necessary and work well together, so that not only the regulatory approval through AOGCC can occur, but that state land can be made available on clear terms that are beneficial to the state, but certain for the operator to utilize the Class 6 permitting on that state land.
And I think I'm following. Thank you.
Representative Hannon and then Representative Colomb. Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Foster. Representative Josephson started on my question, which have to do with this Class 6 primacy. And you've got a slide and a couple ones, but it looks like there's a couple of states that have pursued primacy. Well, I guess it's only Arizona. Primacy separate from comprehensive legislation. And I'm trying to just understand, when did states start doing this? Because it's been described as very new, but I don't know if this is a year ago or 5 years ago. In geologic terms, I'm sure it's all very new. Why would Arizona pursue primacy but not other legislation, or is it just a sequencing of you apply for primacy first and then you worry about enabling legislation and then you see if you can monetize it?
Yeah, Representative Hannon through the chair, John Crowther here. And I apologize for the font on this graphic. On slide 14, and we can speak to it now, I think it's fitting. You can see there's little numbers that say date added, date adopted, and those are actually when those respective states indicated in blue adopted initial framework legislation. And so most of them, there was a period in 2009, 2010 that many states were very active adopting a framework program, and they haven't seen significant project investment in most cases until relatively recently with the expansion of the federal credit. But in answer to the primacy question, I don't want to speak too definitively to the different things that may be under development in Arizona. I don't know if they're considering framework legislation. But for many other states, they have much more private mineral resource or surface resource. And in many states, the CCUS rights go with the surface. But in those areas, that Class 6 permitting is very relevant if you're a private operator who wants to do it and you believe you have secured title to the pore space through a private license. And so you don't necessarily need a broader state framework to manage the resource. Now, that regulatory framework, much of it is incumbent in the Class 6, but it may be hard for a project to be approved, financed, you know, the contracts associated with it entered into in a state like Arizona if they don't provide a framework that enables some of those, gives certainty to those negotiations.
Baldwin?
You pointed out the dates on those. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 09-10, in my mind, that's way before we were talking about carbon sequestration. So does Class 6 wells, does this have to do with the 09-10 time fee? Are those the same type of wells that some states were using for fracking? And I just don't know enough about what Type 6 is. Is that what started that down to a category of primacy separate than other wells?
Yeah, Representative Hannon, through the chair, I may turn to my colleagues for exactly when the Class 6 framework was initiated. But so when they talk about Class 6, that's class in a class of 1 through 6, of what's called the Underground Injection Control Program through the U.S. Safe Drinking Water Act that's administered by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. And so each one of those classes of wells is set standards that a well has to be designed to perform that purpose. So for oil and gas wells, the injection of things to increase recovery, wells that are subject to hydraulic fracturing, I believe that's all under Class 2. The state of Alaska does have that primacy and issues those permits today through the AOGCC, as do many, many other states. Class 6 is a relatively novel part of that UIC program, Underground Injection Control Program, because these projects were actually, you know, the framework legislation in some places predated the pursuit of an actual project. But now, do you know, Ryan, when Class 6 was?
Off the top of my head, I don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can get back to the committee with exactly when Class 6 was initiated, but in response to the identification that people wanted to develop wells specifically for this purpose and that technologically they needed standards specific to the purpose, that's when the Class 6 UIC was developed.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we've got a question, Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Through the chair, pretty simple question. So I'm on slide 12. What accounts for the larger tax credit on the direct air capture? It's quite a bit bigger than the other two. Is the process of capturing that carbon the same, or is it just that it's getting it from the air versus expensive?
Yeah, Representative Colom, through the chair, John Crowther here. The credits are tiered in this way essentially they want to incentivize all these activities, and they in a sense reflect the cost associated with performing that activity. So when you have enhanced oil recovery, you have a additional revenue from that oil value that makes your project economic. When you don't have that enhanced oil recovery, it's that cost, you have to offset that cost, high cost of capture, just with the credit. And then when you have the direct air capture, that cost is even higher because the technology to essentially filter the air is very costly to undertake. And so that's why that credit is set higher to incentivize that kind of activity.
Can I have one follow-up? So is the injection into the ground from direct air capture the same as the others? Is there anything different?
Yeah, Representative Colom, through the chair, for one of these projects, the pressurization and injection of the carbon dioxide is the cost and technology to do that is relatively the same across it. It's that capture that has different technologies to enable the capture and naturally different costs associated with those technologies. And for direct air capture, they're very, very high. For something like a natural gas flue emissions, they're quite high. For something like a flue from a coal plant, they're lower because that carbon dioxide is more concentrated in the emission stream. And still lower in an industrial process because the carbon dioxide is often very concentrated.
Thank you.
Great, thanks. And I believe we're moving on to slide 13.
All right. So slide 13 gives a general overview of the regulatory framework that HB 50 sets up. The objectives of HB 50 are to provide for the use of public lands for CCUS, the licensing and leasing of pore space in the state of Alaska for carbon sequestration. It provides a mechanism for amalgamating property interests and protecting correlative rights. That's a function that right now AIGCC oversees for oil and gas development, essentially creating units around oil and gas, managing the subsurface in a way to protect multiple property owners where you have more than one property owner that might be part of a unit, and just make sure that everything underground in terms of the reservoir is conducted properly. HB 50 also outlines the relationship between other commercial minerals and potential for carbon storage. So where you have potentially an operator that's already exploiting oil and gas reservoirs in an area, if another another operator comes in to propose carbon storage on top of that same area, we have mechanisms in place to try and deconflict that where possible. There are also provisions to address CO2 pipelines, the ownership of carbon dioxide and liability provisions, both during the injection period and then after the injection period when the state takes over the CO2. And then, as alluded to previously, addressing Class 6 well primacy for AIGCC.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, for either gentleman, could you describe what might cause a dispute over liability or create liability is the better description?
Yeah, Representative Josephson, through the chair, John Crowther here. At a very high level, any project nearing its operations, there's liability for safe operations that accrues the project operator. And there's liability for compliance with the regulatory framework in place. And so most of the time in the course of a project operation, when we talk about liability, it's that liability for compliance and liability for, if that compliance or safe operations are not pursued. So there's things like penalty provisions for AOGCC in the legislation. What the bill also sets up is a framework for at the end of project life, an operator to conduct a series of activities to close out a project and then receive regulatory approval through AOGCC for essentially to shut down a project. And when that's the case, the project, the injection ceases, but that carbon dioxide is meant to be permanently in the ground. And so it lays out a way for the liability to essentially be released from the operator after a period of, once the approval's in place, after a period of 10 years, when then the state assumes the liability for that carbon dioxide in place. Essentially, the mineral estate is ours, the project concludes, and so we assume the ownership and thus the liability for the carbon dioxide in place. The legislation does lay out a funding mechanism to, essentially for the state to build up a fund to avoid any costs associated with maintaining and holding that liability. In the event that there's for some reason a well needs to be reclosed, monitoring needs to be escalated, because of some observed migration of the carbon dioxide, we believe those areas of liability would be very limited, would be addressed thoroughly before the closeout, and then that fund would be in place to cover any such costs.
Fund?
All of?
I guess what I'm wondering is, I'm thinking about yesterday, where, for example, we learned in House Bill 49 that the state couldn't enter into an agreement to not reduce its biomass in a state forest and then reduce its biomass in a state forest without having to procure credits elsewhere around the country, theoretically, and sort of make up for that, be penalized for it. And what I guess I'm wondering here, and maybe they don't equate, is would the state have the obligation after year 10 to make sure the CO2 stays where it was put because some other, either Conoco or Tokyo Gas was relying on that in the same way they were relying on us in the timber bill to not harvest timber? In other words, they had been given permission to produce oil in Hokkaido, and in return they needed a reliable capturer of CO2, and that was us. Is it that sort of thing?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, John Crowther here. If I understand the question correctly, you know, right now it's correct to say that people might undertake these projects for all sorts of reasons, and part of undertaking them may be a certification that it'll perform as expected or for the duration expected. And, you know, as it relates to CCUS, that carbon will stay sequestered underground. And we think that this liability framework is part of enabling those kinds of commercial transactions, because a party can reliably say, I will commit to appropriately pursuing my project. I will commit to performing as I am required to under the state regulations. When my project is concluded, I will commit to closing it out under those regulations, getting approval, and then that closeout occurring. And so we imagine that those are the kind of representations parties will make in the market to transact. The representation, well, I don't want to speculate too much, but we think that series of decisions is negotiable, financeable, effective for the investments that people are undertaking today, and practically effective in that carbon dioxide will remain there. But I think we believe this framework legislation meets that need, but it is part of why people are asking about these liability, you know, how do these projects get closed out? What happens if that monitoring does need to be updated? And that's why we, you know, put the provisions and the fund in place.
Thank you.
Representative Gelvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. I think this is probably as good a time as any to ask this question. I've made my way through this bill. It's a lot, and it deals with geology, engineering, subsurface rock dynamics and structure, well safety, surface management, not to mention the use of state resources, and commercial terms and projection of the state revenue. This can all be very, each and every one of these are very complex in and of itself subjects. And I'm wondering if you would provide us with a sense of the expertise that the state relied on to help craft this legislation, and who you will be looking to help guide the state in the implementation of this program if it passes.
Representative Galvin, through the chair, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner here. I think a very good question. If it's okay, we'll jump forward. Given that we've addressed slide 14 and the other states that have both set up frameworks and are pursuing primacy, and these are just a map of both. On slide 15, we have a little bit about our statewide work group that worked over the last year to develop this framework legislation and to review legislation from all around the country to kind of assess what peers and what the best practice is for these provisions. So as you can see on the right, there's a pie chart here, that work group, the composition. The state was very involved. The university is very involved. But also industry partners actively participated in that to assess kind of what's going on in the CCUS space. We retained a consultant, Stantec, to help us formalize that peer state review and assessment. We have a paper of that that's available. We'll make available to the committee to review if you'd like. And then we also, I'd note, you know, we see in this slide the logos of the Institute of Northern Engineering at UAF and the university being very involved. There's also this entity, PCORE, that's been really instrumental, frankly, to our efforts. And that's a organization made up of both industry, academic, and other folks in the CCUS space. It stands for the Plains CO2 Reduction Partnership. It's originally a DOE-funded entity that is studying CO2 in some of those peer states like North Dakota that have been pioneers in this space. And it now has hundreds of members, but the University of Alaska has stepped in with the University of Wyoming and a North Dakota entity to be essentially kind of the chairs of that PCORE partnership. So about a year and a half ago, we hosted the annual meeting here in Alaska, and we've been heavily drawing on that group as an expert resource and as an advisor about what's going on in the space across the country. So we feel we have a really robust suite of both other existing expertise, you know, operational experience that's developing around the country to draw on, and as well as the support from the academic side that's been very, very valuable.
Thank you. A quick follow-up. So this is my understanding then is that this group helped with coming with bringing this together, all of these thoughts in this bill, very lengthy and, you know, quite, I would say that a lot of expertise had to be put into this. I'm wondering if that would be the same group then that would be guiding the state for the implementation as things progress should this pass. Is that the intent?
Representative Galvin, through the chair, John Crowther again here, I think that this group is continuing to meet, and all of these entities individually would be continue to be a resource. I think we've developed, I should let my colleague Ryan Fitzpatrick speak because he's been instrumental in our state's efforts to survey other jurisdictions, engage with other jurisdictions, and these partners. But both the legislation itself and the ongoing implementation, we continue to draw on all these relationships we've been developing.
Mr. Fitzpatrick, do you have any comments?
I'll just say that the state work group, the state CCOS work group that was stood up by the university, something that continues to meet even today. In fact, literally today, there is a CCUS symposium that was being held this morning by some of the members of that work group, sort of in preparation for the Energy Summit coming up here in Anchorage in a couple of months. The group that's been formed initially just as a study group around the idea of CCUS, before this was even sort of intended as a legislative idea, was really just to see if, you know, this is something that is a good fit for the state of Alaska. It's something that DNR has been involved in now going back at least a year and a half, you know, almost to the 2 year mark, looking at this from a study perspective. And as that work group sort of developed an understanding of what CCUS is through a number of meetings, looked at this as something that might be a potentially good fit for Alaska and realized that that was going to take legislation. That work group then sort of evolved into a sort of a think tank or a listening session for what needed to happen in terms of the legislation. And so back in August of last year, the university put on sort of a regulatory symposium to come up with all of the stakeholders' ideas in terms of what would need to be accomplished in legislation to make CCUS a reality in the state of Alaska. And so while the Department of Law had a great hand in crafting the actual language that you see in front of you, the concepts behind many of those pieces came out of that August summit that was put on by the university and that all of these people participated in. And then, you know, again, even after that August symposium, continuing to draw on the expertise of PCORE, the university, and a number of those stakeholders to sort of refine the legislation. So.
Okay. And I think that's all I've got for questions. If you want to continue with the presentation.
Okay. I think we'll continue on from there. This slide is just summarizing, and Ryan Fitzpatrick for the record. This slide is summarizing CCUS opportunities that we see for the state of Alaska. As we've stated before, you know, the development of CCUS has the potential to help continue the development of Alaska's oil and gas resources. Those federal incentives, the 45Q tax credits, in addition to other funding that's been made available by the federal government under the infrastructure bill, provides the financial incentives that are driving the development of this industry. Environmental goals, we saw the slide earlier about many of our oil and gas operators that are looking to manage or reduce their carbon output. But those sorts of goals are driving interest in these opportunities. The development of CCUS as an industry. We had a slide, I believe, earlier that alluded to 35 CCUS facilities that are in operation worldwide as of a couple of months ago. There are over 60 facilities right now that are in the development phase. And so it's possible within the next couple of years that the percentage is going to increase dramatically. the amount of CO2 that's being captured by CCUS facilities has increased by over 44% in the last 12 months. This is a small industry, but it's a very rapidly growing industry. And so that's why we see this as a potential opportunity for the state. Because of the project timelines, especially when we look at development projects in Alaska, we see that as a reason why this is an exciting prospect, but something that we need to bring forward at this point in time. Again, according to our constitutional mandate of maximizing the value of our state's resources, we see this as a way to potentially bring in additional state revenues, both in terms of potential injection fees for CO2 storage itself, but also potentially for enhanced oil recovery and maximizing the value of other state resources as well.
Representative Colon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So through the chair, I just wanted to maybe highlight something. We had talked about this one-on-one yesterday. So in response to the additional state revenue, so this project doesn't have a separate carbon account. So these, the what I think you said in the office yesterday was that these are going to go directly into UGF. The only account that was there was something to do with around possibly the liability portion. But did I get that right, that is the revenue coming from CC would be going into UGF?
Representative Colum, through the chair, John Crowther here. That is correct. The revenues from the use of the state pore space mineral resource would accrue to the state, some to the permanent fund and some to the general fund. There is contemplated in the legislation that liability fund, so a small charge for all projects would go into that. And then the AOGCC operations for the regulations, there'd be similar to their existing regulatory cost charge for oil and gas. There'd be that assessment dedicated to provide those operations so the state wouldn't have to incur general fund spending for that regulatory cost. But the primary revenue from the use of the state resource would go to the general fund.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
All right. So the next set of slides, we're going to start looking at sort of an overview of CCUS projects and how they're developed. This is going to be the first of several slides that will show potential timelines of CCUS project development. And so just walking through this particular timeline looks at CCUS project sort of through the lens of that Safe Drinking Water Act and Class 6 well application process. So a CCUS project starts out in the exploratory phase. At that point, the project is not yet dealing with Class 6 issues. It's mainly surface exploration, potentially seismic exploration, that sort of thing. It's only once a project advances to the permitting phase. Prior to drilling the first Class 6 well, they apply for the Class 6 permit, and that phase can last several months to anywhere up to several years currently before that first well is permitted. Advancing, it goes into the storage phase. The injection wells are drilled. CO2 is injected into the formation, and this is the phase of just normal operations for the CCUS project. Advancing further, once that storage phase ends, there's a closure period. You're still under the Class 6 well jurisdiction, that's the period in time. Injection's no longer taking place, but you're taking measures to ensure that a site has been properly abandoned, that any surface infrastructure is removed. And you're monitoring the CO2 underground to ensure that the CO2 plume underground has stabilized, that it's no longer moving underground, to make sure that everything is stored the way that you expect it to be stored underground. And then finally, the last phase, the post-closure phase, once again, you're no longer under the strict jurisdiction of the Class 6 well, but because of the regulations around that injection, some of those associated with the Class 6 well program, there is a monitoring phase that can take place over a number of years, sometimes up to 50 years, where you continue to monitor that CO2 even after site closure for an amount of time.
We've got a question, Representative Sapp.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair, to our wonderful folks at DNR. So my understanding would be that successful CO2 storage underground in perpetuity would probably require pretty sophisticated monitoring devices and regulatory guidance. In the bill, I see basically regulatory authority being delegated to DNR and DEC. So my question is, I would imagine we as the legislative body would probably have a say in what regulatory requirements would be required in order to facilitate this process. And I guess reading the text of the bill, it just seems relatively arbitrary as far as how you would actually ensure that you had the monitoring and regulatory requirements necessary to facilitate this. Thanks.
Yeah, Representative Stapp, through the chair, John Crowther here. We can get into this in more detail in the sectional analysis, but as it relates to, you know, closure specifically and the monitoring associated, I guess, monitoring associated with an ongoing project and then during closure, there are criteria for the approval of a storage permit that have to be met, and there's also criteria for the closure of a storage permit that implicate monitoring. And so we think that is explicitly required by the bill. The application of those requirements by AOGCC would often be through the maintenance of a monitoring well, so that you're able to assess what's going on in that subsurface, if you're seeing that how you're seeing that carbon dioxide migrate. There's other methods of assessing the subsurface, different seismic technologies and other methods that we believe could be required, either at different intervals or, you know, prior to a closure, etc. So we believe the framework is it required in the statutory language itself and would be implicated or administered that way by AOGCC, but certainly discussion of the particular items there, we're happy to engage. And it, as you mentioned, it is totally the legislature's prerogative to set those terms.
And if I could add, Ryan Fitzpatrick, for the record, one of the other aspects of that regulatory structure when looking at this particular bill is if AOGCC pursues Class 6 primacy, the Class 6 regulations that exist right now in the federal government under the EPA program for Class 6 wells, those regulatory requirements would have to be adopted by AOGCC essentially by reference. There is some leeway in that primacy application to tailor or customize those regulations to the particular jurisdiction. But those regulations do set sort of the minimum standards for Class 6 well operation. And so that's going to cover things like the well design, ensuring that the CO2 isn't being injected into potential drinking water sources, pressures that you're injecting into the formation, the long-term monitoring and how that's achieved. So a lot of that is covered under federal regulation that AOGCC would then have to adopt as well.
Thanks.
Representative Josephson?
Through the chair, you noted that there could be monitoring up to 50 years. And I'm wondering if we're at year 10, so we're in post-closure, how do we know, how would the committee measure what the cost is of monitoring the other 40 years? And is that balanced with an income stream? Or is the income in the first decade? Is there any way to know that sort of thing?
So the intention with regards to the long-term monitoring, first of all, the 10 years post-closure before the state takes over that responsibility is really a minimum period of term. It's not just 10 years and then the state takes over. The intention there is that AOGCC would only issue that closure certificate once the agency is satisfied that everything has occurred properly in terms of dismantlement, removal, remediation of the facilities, that the monitoring infrastructure has already been set up for the state to assume. And so hypothetically, if you've got an injection well, that can be set up to allow for monitoring into the formation, and the state can take over the operation of that well. But the idea is that really what AOGCC is looking for is that the CO2 underground has stabilized, that it's no longer moving around underground, that the plume itself has become stationary. And so at that point, the idea is that absent something very significant happening underground, the CO2 really should just be staying in place. We'd have the monitoring infrastructure that was left over during that closure process. So it's possible the state may need to, at some point if something were to occur, possibly go in and re-enter that well in order to potentially enhance or replace some of the monitoring equipment downhole. But for the most part, it's looking at continual monitoring through that well, continual monitoring through occasional seismic surveys. But the idea is that because that plume is stabilized, that the potential risks at that point are fairly well delineated and known.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, John Crowther here. I just supplement on slide 25, where we're in the funding sources, we have a little bit more specific reference to the language in the bill and the Carbon Storage Closure Trust Fund, which is essentially fees collected during operations would build up in that fund to provide a funding source for the long-term monitoring if required, and thus offset those costs from being an ongoing state expenditure.
Thank you.
Okay. Please continue.
All right. Moving on to the next slide. This is the next of our timeline slides. This is looking at CCUS development less through the lens of Class 6 well permitting, but more from just overall project development standpoint. So you can see it's going through the timeline, the screening period initially. Potential operators looking at legacy data that might already exist, potential geologic surveys of the area. Going into the next area of feasibility, that's when an operator is sort of down selected to a specific area that they're going to be looking at. They may be doing test wells at that point. They may be doing core samples, seismic surveys. Once at the end of that feasibility period, there's essentially a go, no-go decision at that point. If they decide to proceed, they move into project design and permitting. You can see all the activities that sort of take place during that that period in time. That's when most of the permitting for the project takes place. There's the regulatory review of all of the permitting. Under the design of this bill, that would occur primarily at DNR, AOGCC, and potentially DEC to the extent that there are CO2 pipelines involved in the project. And then there's a final investment decision that would lead into the investment and the construction of the project. And that's sort of the period in time where a project has to hit prior to 2033 in order to qualify for the 45Q tax credits as the tax credits currently exist in federal law. So the next slide looks at one project that's already in development down in the lower 48. This is the Red Tail Energy Project. So just to give the committee kind of a sense of, what a potential project looks like. In this case, in the map, you can see this is a fairly small project. There's a single injection well that's sort of the green circle in the middle of that purple sort of outlined area in the middle of the map. There's a monitoring well also. You can see it's a sort of white circle a little bit towards the edge of that that purple area. The total area for the project is 3,480 acres, surface acres. That's the white outline. And this particular project is sequestering 180,000 metric tons per year of CO2. So this is a fairly small scale project, single well, under 200,000 metric tons. But it does sort of demonstrate that these sorts of projects can be achieved at, relatively small scale. But then they can also be scaled up into larger projects as well, primarily depending on local geography or geology.
Representative Colomb, and then Representative Hammond.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Chair. Through the Chair, so I'm just noticing that if Orange is residential land, it's awfully close to, looks like the scale is 1 mile down the corner. So I was surprised at that. There's no concern that you can have it close to population centers and residential areas?
Yeah, Representative Cullum, through the Chair, just for additional information for the committee, you're correct that that indicated there in that orange, that is a community in North Dakota. Those lands you see, some of them are in the kind of green squares. Those are obviously surface land divisions. You see agricultural activities, other surface activities, essentially on top of where that carbon sequestration is taking place. The white area outlined is the subsurface extent of those rights that had to be secured, but other activities can certainly occur on that surface area and are. And from a, you know, community proximity perspective, any industrial site has to be, you know, just like our oil and gas sites on the Kenai, has to be appropriately operated to avoid specific incidents. You know, just like a carbon dioxide injection facility has to, you know, have setbacks and operational safety parameters. But there's not a concern about having it essentially right next to other land uses or even communities.
Representative Hannon? Oh, Mr. Fitzpatrick?
I just wanted to add, and Ryan Fitzpatrick for the record, one of the feature of CCUS projects, especially when it comes to sort of the surface use, is that once the wells are in place, unlike oil and gas, if you're just looking at a pure sequestration project, the amount of surface facilities is relatively minimal. Really, it's just the wellhead that you're injecting into some form of pipeline to transport the CO2 into that wellhead. But the wellhead itself, that you know, well pad and facility, may be relatively small, certainly not like the surface facilities that you might see in an oil and gas development where the surface infrastructure is in place to process the oil after it's extracted. Here, it's just simply inserting or sequestering the CO2 underground. There isn't the associated surface infrastructure for processing the oil and gas that oil and gas developments see on the surface. So it is potential that a pure sequestration project in terms of surface use is going to be much more minimal.
Representative Hammond?
Thank you, Chair Foster. So I want to know more about this Red Tail Energy project you've put up as an example. Is the carbon being delivered from somewhere else? Is there a pipeline? Or is this a former site that was producing and they're no longer producing and they have carbon right there in the neighborhood? Are they the same company that's producing and getting the credit for sequestration? So just tell me a little more about this example you've laid out.
I can speak to the extent that I'm familiar with the project. I believe if we have Haley Payne or Aaron O'Quinn from the Division of Oil and Gas, they may know more about this particular project. My understanding is that this particular project is sequestering CO2 that's been captured from coal plants in coal power plants in North Dakota. Perhaps if we have those other individuals, they might be able to provide a little bit more information on this particular project.
Did you say Haley Payne? Was that?
Yeah.
Haley Payne, if you're there, if you want to put yourself on the record.
Hi, yes, thank you. And this is Haley Payne, Deputy Director at the Division of Oil and Gas, for the record. Representative Hannon, through the chair, just for a little bit of background, the Red Tail Energy Project is actually an ethanol facility. Ethanol produces a very high-quality stream of CO2 as a byproduct of the fermentation process. There is not an existing transportation network that brings this into the area. The facility happened to be co-located, luckily enough, on top of a geologically suitable sequestration site. And so it just goes directly from the facilities itself into the subsurface for storage. So the surface footprint, I think, is a little bit of a white shack at this point in time. There are other projects under development in North Dakota that do involve transportation networks with pipelines, but this one is currently just co-located.
Want to follow up?
I do. Thank you, Chair Foster. I guess it makes my wheels spin, and going back to when we talked about the groups in Alaska that were, you know, our think tank working group,
whether the corporate partners who participated in that were companies who said, I got this project already going. I'm an ethanol facility, and the sequestration, I think we could co-locate. Were they, you know, individual corporations going, this is how it would work here in Alaska on this example that we have, versus the theoretical, you know, when we're looking at this example with residents nearby, that's where I was trying to figure out, if, you know, you were trying to get a pipeline permit and the haulback facility. There were a lot of things that would have forestalled it, but the ethanol plant was already there and the carbon being sequestered. That's, I guess, the example that I assume companies in Alaska are looking at. What have I got going that I can sequester right there so I'm not dealing with all these other things that are not ancillary to it being productive, but lay other risk factors on there. So I don't know if when our working group went around, whether those corporate participants were actually going, I got a tract in mind that I think is going to work for this.
Yeah, Representative Hannon through the chair, John Crowther here again. And Haley, please do interject it after I speak if there's additional specifics. But so that work group has involved all sorts of companies. So companies, that, you know, service companies that are do any kind of industrial operation subject to project and client demands. They included companies like ConocoPhillips and Exxon, who have existing operations on the North Slope, not in a, oh, we plan to do X project on X date if this work group or this legislation passes, but, you know, that are actively understanding the CCUS opportunities associated with their existing operations in Alaska. The Usabelli has been very active in the effort because they, I think, are actively trying to understand the sequestration potential in the interior. And so we have that group has seen participation from companies that we understand have much more Alaska project-specific ideas and companies that are very much in a kind of conceptual what's going on in Alaska. You know, we are interested in this kind of activity anywhere. Let's understand it in Alaska as well. And so we think a spectrum was represented there, if that answers your question.
Thank you.
Okay. Please proceed.
And so the next slide is Ryan Fitzpatrick, sorry, for the record. The next slide is a little bit more information about that Redtail Energy project in North Dakota. You know, this for a relatively small facility co-located with the plant that it's sequestering from. There was a five-year evaluation and design period. So, again, we see sort of that development period for these sorts of projects. North Dakota was granted Class 6 well primacy in 2018. It was one of the very first states to receive Class 6 well primacy from the EPA. And that storage facility permit was then issued on October 19th, 2021. Commercial operations began in 2022. So again, we sort of see that development time period from obtaining Class 6 well primacy, going through the evaluation and development period, permitting, and then finally into commercial operation can take a number of years.
We got a question, Representative Galtman.
Thank you, through the chair, Foster. I hope that you can help us know what Class 6 wells are like. Is there anything in Alaska that's similar? And I'm just trying to help translate that to the timing for Alaska, for example.
Certainly, Representative Galvin, through the chair. In terms of the well type, there are no Class 6 wells in the state of Alaska right now. There are several in North Dakota, I believe a few in Wyoming, and I believe there's two in Illinois. There are many others that are currently under permitting process right now, but those permits haven't been issued. In terms of an analogy to the state of Alaska, AOGCC currently has permitting authority for Class 2 injection wells, and so those are the wells that are associated with enhanced oil recovery or injection for oil and gas operations, water flood, gas, miscible injectant, that sort of thing for oil and gas. And so it's similar in the sense that you are injecting some sort of substance into the subsurface. Under that program, AIGCC has to manage the injection, what's being injected in underground, where it's being injected, that it's not interfering with drinking water. the pressure that it's being injected to ensure that it's not compromising reservoir integrity. And so that sort of expertise is something that AIGCC is also already familiar with. Class 6 wells are somewhat different from Class 2 wells. There are differences between the two wells. Obviously, EPA has a different permitting structure for Class 6 wells than for Class 2 wells. In part, that's to do with the fact that you're injecting a different type of substance, although you can inject CO2 in a Class 2 well as well. But more, it's looking at the requirements to ensure that when you're injecting CO2 for sequestration purposes, that you're injecting it into a zone where it's going to be sequestered for a longer period of time. There's also concerns or an attempt to manage any possible concern over the injection of that to make sure it's not interfering with drinking water, given the longevity of that substance underground in the subsurface. So it's a different regulatory category, but it's similar to the Class 2 wells that AIGCC already permits.
Follow-up.
Thank you. So if I'm hearing your definition correct, what I'm hearing is that Class 6 is for CO2, and it's for a long period of time, a longer period, 50 years potentially, and then there's also some regulations around drinking water and such as well. But Class 2 wells, which we currently have, may work for the sequestration that we're also talking about, but we might need primacy. Is that what I'm hearing?
Representative Galvin, through the chair, CO2 can be sequestered in a Class 2 well currently if it's being used for enhanced oil recovery. And so that's part of the regulations that the EPA has around Class 2 wells and what they can be used for. So if you're injecting CO2 just to get more oil and gas out of the ground, you may also qualify for that enhanced oil recovery 45Q tax credit. The state of Alaska allows the CO2 injection right now for enhanced oil recovery. But if a company were to come to the state and want to propose a pure sequestration project, it may be that, you know, you have CO2 that's being that's coming in on a barge from Asia. It may be that there's more CO2 than could be accommodated by enhanced oil recovery. It may be that there are other factors that go into that decision. But for pure sequestration, that's where a Class 6 well is required. Not to get too technical, there is a period in time where EPA has indicated that there might be a requirement to switch between Class 6 well, a Class 2 well and a Class 6 well if it appears that you're using a Class 2 well solely for sequestration. They don't want you sort of like fudging there. But primarily the Class 6 well is for sequestration purposes. And so if we want to do pure sequestration projects in the state of Alaska, that's where we really need the Class 6 well jurisdiction for.
Okay. Please continue.
The next slide is another timeline slide. This is looking at a lot of the same sort of development timeline of the previous slides that we've looked at. What we've done here, though, is match up those different stages of the timeline with the different sections in this particular bill. So going through the exploration stage, you can see reference to Section 16 in the bill, issuance of the facility permit, Section 33, AOGCC's Class 6 well primacy, the authorization for them to seek Class 6 well primacy shows up in class or in Section 3 of the bill. So looking at this is sort of a guide for us to be able to see when we talk about these different time periods in the development of a CCUS project. It's a reference for where in the bill those sections show up. What you'll see if you look at the different sections that are referenced, Section 16 and Section 33, which we'll get into in the sectional analysis, that's really the meat of the bill, are those two sections right there. Section 16 sets up the authorization for DNR to lease state lands for carbon storage. And so it's sort of the licensing and leasing process for the state to use its mineral estate for CCUS. Section 33 is really the AOGCC management of carbon storage activities. And so those two sections are really the meat of the bill. There are other sections, Section 3 for classic soil primacy, Section 39 for some of the classics or the post-closure activities. There are a couple of sections that deal with pipelines. But for the major parts of the bill, we're looking at Section 16 and Section 33 of the bill.
Okay, and I think that's the end of that slide. So I think we're getting close to the end of our time, and rather than we've got two more sections, we've got the funding and revenue section and then the sectional summary. And rather than start into the funding and revenue and then have to quit halfway through, maybe we'll just go ahead and adjourn our meeting for today and then take this up at our next meeting. So before we do adjourn, though, we'll take questions. Representative Tomaszewski.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Foster, through the chair. So a lot of talk about carbon dioxide. We know that plants use carbon dioxide for photosynthesis. And I'm just assuming that somewhere, somehow, sometime, we have a study that says there's too much CO2 in the air. Is there a slide, or are you going to get that information out that, I guess the question is, who's monitoring how much CO2 is in the atmosphere, and how do we know we're not going to starve all of our farmers who rely on carbon dioxide to grow their plants big and strong so we have vegetables and fruits? So that's just a kind of a something you probably don't have, but maybe you can bring.
Yeah, Representative Tomaszewski through the chair, John Crowther here. I think the, you know, whether it's in a localized sense or in a global sense, the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you know, people are trying to study it to attribute different effects it has either locally or globally. You know, obviously its presence in the atmosphere is necessary for plant life, the growth of plant life. These kinds of processes are focused on an industrial activity occurring, often the hydrocarbon, you know, production and utilization, and sequestering the emissions associated with that. And so in the, I guess if you look at the kind of total carbon content of the atmosphere, there's an increasing amount because of emissions from the consumption of everything from coal to natural gas, oil. The aim of these projects is to diminish the emissions, new emissions, by sequestering things that come out of essentially the back end of these processes, either industrial or consumption for energy. And so it's not, you know, in theory, in the future, there may be an effort to decrease the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. You know, that's kind of a hypothetical world we're not quite in yet, as far as this technology and the applications that we're proposing. So I think it is that, from my perspective, that kind of concern is much more relevant to that type of consideration, in the sense that carbon dioxide being available for plants to continue to grow would very much continue to be there, and that cycle would that natural cycle would continue, as these CCUS projects are focused on, well, new coal emissions that add to the atmosphere composition of CO2 are instead limited, so that composition remains where it is. If that answers, we're happy to try and provide some kind of overall charts of those trends.
I would like to see the follow up. I would like to see the overall trends and who's been, you know, measuring this throughout the years and decades, and see where it all falls into line. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Cologne.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. So through the chair, so I'm sorry I'm not a geologist, but I just want to clarify. So part of the presentation, you were talking about the CO2 migrating. There's also something about having a top or a dense topper. So what happens to the CO2 when it gets injected in there? Is it static? It stays in that hole, or does it eventually migrate? Or does, and I guess this is part of the monitoring of the pressure. Does it, the pressure never, like, and I've addressed this with you before, when I think a gas, you know, gas expands. And so I'm just trying to think the long term, kind of a little bit to what a representative staff was talking about around seismic activity. And I know you're drilling way down underground water, but there was a lot about drinking water and what happens if it seeps into drinking water. So I guess my question is it static? Is it actually, if it's monitored, does it stay there or does it actually move through the sediment or the rock over time?
Yeah, Representative Cullum, through the chair, John Crowther here, at a very high level and not, also not being a geologist, I'll speak at my simple level, and then Ryan and others may want to supplement. The simply and narratively, the goal is to pressurize the carbon dioxide and introduce it to the reservoir and let it migrate throughout the reservoir to an extent where the pressure of the injection kind of balances the general pressure. And so it migrates up until a point, and then it is generally stable in place. And over geologic time, there's actually changes that incorporate it potentially into that reservoir. But in relative human time, it's high pressure, supercritical carbon dioxide gas that is sitting in that reservoir, kind of in a pressure equilibrium with the existing reservoir pressure. I don't think we specifically talked to it, but there's something called the hydrostatic pressure, the pressure of all of the water and geologic column above a reservoir that sets a pressure environment in that depth, and that's what keeps that carbon dioxide at that pressurized level once it's injected. And that's why it has to be 2,600 feet or deeper, because you want enough hydrostatic pressure to keep it pressurized.
Okay, that explains it. Thank you.
And if I can add Ryan Fitzpatrick through the chair, Representative Cullum, one of the other aspects of that, and I will say this, also not a geologist, but one of the other aspects of that is, you know, thinking to the analogy of oil and gas, you think about the geologic traps that sort of, you know, keep oil and gas in place underground, geologic strata underground where you've got impermeable layers beyond which the oil and gas can't seep up from. And so, again, you know, sort of similar analogy here, you're looking at places where you can inject CO2, where as it migrates, it's going to naturally migrate in the direction of one of those underground traps. And so you've got a column above, an impermeable column above, through which the CO2 can't migrate past.
Thank you. Well, seeing no additional questions, first of all, I want to say thank you for the presentation today. And I didn't quite get through it, but we'll probably, I'm certain, and have some intention to have you back and continue on. So thank you, Commissioner Boyle, who was not with us but on the phone, Deputy Commissioner Crowther, and Mr. Fitzpatrick. So our next scheduled House Finance Committee meeting is at 1:30 p.m. tomorrow, Wednesday, April 12th. At that meeting, we will hear two Medicaid bills, House Bill 58, Medicaid Assistance for Adult Home Care, and House Bill 59, Medicaid Eligibility for Postpartum Mothers. With that, at 3:30, we are adjourned.